Art competitions were held as part of the 1948 Summer Olympics, also in London. And medals were awarded for architecture, literature, music, painting, and sculpture. A Finnish person won the gold medal in the lyric works category of the literature section for a poem called Laurel of Hellas, which went like this. This is an English translation. I don't know what it was like in the original, but Laurel of Hellas, noble born, you tree of honoured name, reaching over unnumbered years, your leaves extend their fame, and branches high proclaim the pride of one who never bowed except to place your crown upon the victor's brow. Skipping the second verse, quickly to the third verse, Laurel of Hellas, noble born, most celebrated tree, gazing to your lofty crown, the mind must dazzled be. Up to the blue your head is raised, to earth your strong root strains, and under your shining leaves are played the noble, timeless games. They didn't anticipate the Arctic Monkeys in 1948, obviously. Professor Brian Boyd is an acclaimed expert on and author of books about Vladimir Nabokov. And now Professor Boyd, he is Professor of English at the University of Auckland, is one of the foremost scholars in the field of evolutionary literary criticism, which examines, I think roughly expressed, how the mind has adapted to literature and the arts. He has written a book about why we love stories, fiction, untrue tales, called On the Origin of Stories. And now he's examined why we, some of us, like some lyric poetry, like that one what I just read, no stories or narrative. This book is called Why Lyrics Last, Evolution, Cognition, and Shakespeare's Sonnets. And Professor Brian Boyd joins me now in our Auckland studio. Hello.
Hi, Kim.
As I understand it, the philosopher Karl Popper's theory was that scientific knowledge advanced through an evolutionary process. Are you trying to apply that to literature?
Well, I'm trying to understand why, how human nature, as shaped by evolution, makes us into storytelling animals, and to what extent that inflects the way we read poetry. So it seems quite clear that we have a compulsion to engage in stories. It's not quite so clear that we have a compulsion to engage in poems like that one that you just read out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was lyric in the sense that it didn't have a story.
Yes.
You talk about, in The Origin of Stories, about the attraction that we have for narrative and safe play, safe mental play,
mm-hmm.
and trying out stuff in terms of experimentation. But that doesn't explain why we like lyric verse, does it?
No, we engage in pretend play as children. We attend to stories all through our lives. We really are compulsive about it, and I suggest that helps train us in understanding how to interpret events, how to formulate possible events, and so on. But certain aspects of verse really engage us. Kids love to taunt each other with rhyming chants. They love nursery rhymes and so on. But gradually, as they get a little older, they tend to turn off verse, except perhaps in the form of pop song lyrics, which use rhyme very extensively, or raps, say. And part of my puzzle in this latest book is to figure out why even do a lot of literature students not really get poetry. They confess to us, well, I just don't get poetry. Why should poetry be such a delight for some and a turn-off for many?
Why do you think it is a delight for some?
Well, because it's I guess it's a little almost like cryptic crosswords or crosswords. Something it really engages the mind quite intensely. You have to focus at least on if we're talking about high literary verse. You do have to engage. You have to tackle things in a different way. You have to for a lyric. You usually have to read and reread and reread. You have to read at least three times, I think, before you can say, well, you know, I like this or I don't. And that's of course not how many people are used to reading. They want an instant hit, and we get instant hits from story. But lyrics are, they focus the attention in a special way, and they really ask a lot of the attention.
Because they're patterns without narrative.
Yes. And poets are usually trying to load as much as they can into every line, and that's fun to unpack if you've developed a taste for it and expertise at it. But for others, it's just it seems impenetrable.
We will unpack one of Shakespeare's sonnets a little later, but I wanted to ask you why you regard Shakespeare's sonnets as the most successful of lyric projects and the most problematic. Why problematic?
Because nobody can figure out what's going on. Is it a narrative? Is it about his relationship to a young man to whom the first 126 sonnets are addressed? And
are they, though?
Well, yes.
I mean, they're not specifically. A lot of those are just not specified as to who, which gender.
That's right. I mean, there are puzzles all over the place. I mean, I think we know that a play like Hamlet is full of questions. It keeps on. Questions keep on reverberating within it and in the minds of audiences. And I think in the same way, but to a higher degree almost, he's made the sonnets utterly mystifying. Are they frank autobiographical confessions? In these sonnets, did Shakespeare unpack his heart, as Wordsworth claimed? And then Browning's response was, did he so? If so, the less Shakespeare he. So we don't even know whether they're autobiographical or not. We didn't know when they were composed, whether they were composed all at once. We don't know the relationship between one sonnet and the next. There's just a jump, and some of the sonnets themselves are very demanding.
We don't know the order. Most importantly, really, isn't it? We don't know the order in which, if we want, we try to impose narrative on the whole bunch of them.
A lot of people have, yes. And a lot of people have tried to have constructed new editions with the poems in a different order in order to make apparent the narrative that they want to see in it. But nobody else accepts their order. So we've got 40 or 50 different attempts to reconstruct the sonnets as Shakespeare really would have wanted them. But in fact, the evidence seems to be coming in now that it was Shakespeare who determined the order.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just going back to the concept of evolution in the context of lyrics, Darwin did say that he thought it wasn't possible to explain art at all by evolution. Did he not? Was he wrong?
Yes, I think he was. He didn't have he had many amazing insights that we're still unpacking. But on the other hand, the application of evolution to human psychology, which he foresaw in time, really has happened only in the last 20 or 30 years, and there's simply a lot of evidence that needed to come together before we could really apply evolution to literature.
Somebody has said, I can't remember who said it, I wrote it down, to prove that art is directly adaptive, one would have to show that people who write symphonies or listen to symphonies have more children than people who do not. Or one might devise a neurological test to show that an hour of Wagner renders your reflexes a millisecond or two quicker. The point being that you can't do that, therefore there can't be a link.
Well, let's take a thought experiment. Beavers build dams, and if beavers spend a lot of energy and time building dams. If they did not benefit from building their dams, then presumably the very strong instinct to build dams would die out. Those beavers who didn't waste their time by building dams would do better. We know no culture in human life that does not engage in all of the arts. And presumably, if these very time-consuming activities bore us no benefit, we would have evolved into creatures who were not engaged in the arts. But manifestly, we engage in stories, we engage in visual art even more than we ever did in the past. The music is constantly available. It's not really that people who compose symphonies and so on need to breed more children. The question really is, do people who never engage in art suffer from never engaging in art? And the only way to do that would be to create an experiment where you deprived somebody of any exposure to the arts in infancy. And of course, that would be ethically intolerable. But you can imagine that the consequences would not be very good for the child.
No. But then, not only is it not adaptive, some say, perfectly respectable scientific people like Steven Pinker and Stephen Jay Gould, they say it's just a byproduct. It's a spandrel, Stephen Jay Gould called it. Didn't Steven Pinker say it was cheesecake, or was that
cheesecake for the mind? Yes,
cheesecake for the mind.
Yes, but again, you know, he's thinking that if we want to talk about art, we need to think about black velvet paintings and so on, and not high art. I think we need to go to much simpler things even than that. We need to think about things like pretend play or children doodling, creating things out of clay, or you know, covering paper with paint and so on. The important thing, I think, is the difference it makes to individual minds especially earlier in their development, when they engage with the art, when they have this very intense dose of high pattern making that they get in art, and this compulsion to engage in it again and again, to repeat nursery rhymes and so on. And maybe it's perfectly possible that art could be adaptive as a developmental process, and not necessarily be adaptive in modern conditions. Just as we have a taste for sugar and for sweet and fat, because those high energy sources were worth the effort of trying to track down in the past when they were not readily available. But now, when they're readily available, everybody's at risk of diabetes. And possibly the surfeit of stories available now on TV and in film and in libraries and comics and so on is not actually any longer adaptive, that we overdose on stories. And it'd be very interesting to try and tease out whether that is the case.
Do you think that should open up a new market for the non-narrative lyric? The reason I asked that was there's a new iPad app with Shakespeare's sonnets. Did you see that?
Yes, yes.
With commentary from Don Patterson, who I think you know quite well, don't you?
Well, I know
his work. Commentary.
Yes.
He disagrees with some of the things you suggest, does he not?
Yeah, that's right, yes. He thinks the sonnets have to be read as a narrative of the progress of love.
Yes.
And I think that's bollocks. I think...
Bollocks? It's a poetic word then. Bollocks? Why do you
Well, it's
not,
the sort of word
why
he
do
would
you,
use.
Why do you discard that? Because that is one of the draw cards for the sonnets. You think, oh, and what's happened now? And who's he writing to? And what's happened to that one? And who's
there are constant shifts in the emotional plane, but you don't. There is no inevitable narrative. No sense that if at one point things go sour in the relationship, then Shakespeare is going to reflect that in later poems. Later poems will say after things have gone sour. Things like, but you like none you for constant heart. Even though he's just 20 poems earlier, he's accused the poet, the lover, of betrayal. They just don't make sense in narrative terms. They capture the intensity of emotions that we're used to in narrative situations, and the sense of a speaker speaking to someone he's very deeply engaged with. They use all that, but they don't actually tell you a story.
A lot of them, you know, as we've said, some of them are called the Dear Youth sonnets, and the other ones are called the Dark Lady sonnets.
Yeah.
But some of the Dear Youth ones, I don't know. I mean, sonnet number one from Fairest,
yes.
Creatures as We Desire Increase, is obviously You Say to a Male, but couldn't he call a woman Tender Churl?
It seems not, no.
In the day?
Yeah.
No?
No.
Okay.
And certainly the next sonnets make clear that it's a he that he's addressing, and those first 17 sonnets are all very much of a piece. They're all arguing, harping on the same theme. Why don't you get married and reproduce yourself so that you don't have to wither into old age with nothing, no glimpse of your former beauty.
Mm. And are they homoerotic?
Well, that has been discussed a lot. In fact, certainly in the late 18th century and in the 19th century, early 20th century, there were some who almost thought the sonnets should be suppressed because they seemed so clearly homoerotic to them. And more recently, with gay rights and so on, people have taken them as quite clearly homoerotic. There's a wonderful quote from one of the best editors of the sonnets who says that Shakespeare was almost certainly either homosexual or bisexual or heterosexual. But the sonnets give us no information about any of this.
No, what do you think?
I think whether he was homosexual or bisexual, I don't know. Clearly he's quite sympathetic to that way of thinking, and so I think he... He's gay friendly, if you like, in modern terms. But I think that he developed this long run of intensely passionate poems to a male. It seems to me that he probably developed it not so much as an expression of his own experience, but in order to attract attention to play with love and friendship in ways that are that were quite new within a system of poetry, the sonnet sequence, that had been very fashionable but was rather wearing itself out.
I asked you to choose a sonnet that we could look at more closely to unpack, and you've chosen sonnet number 33, which I'm assuming, because of its position as 33, is one of the Fair Youth sonnets.
That's right, yes.
Do you want to read it?
Sure. Let me just preface it with a remark or two. All the sonnets up to now have been love poems, and one of the fascinating things about the sonnet is that Shakespeare's constantly surprising you, so that this poem doesn't actually address love for quite a time, or in a way you have to infer that it's about love from its position after these 32 sonnets about an ideal love. And here... For the first time, something less than ideal is happening. Okay. Sonnet 33. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. Anon, permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly wrack on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace. Even so, my sun one early morn did shine with all triumphant splendour on my brow. But out, alack, he was but 1 hour mine, the region cloud hath masked him from me now. Yet him for this my love no whit disdaineth. Suns of the world may stain when heaven's sun staineth.
Sonnet number 33. Just a quick note about the structure. Was the sonnet structure always that? A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E?
In the Shakespearean or English pattern, yes. In the Italian or Petrarchan pattern, it's A, B, B, A, C, D, C, D, and then various different forms for the sestet.
Right.
So you can hear here the very clear division into the first two quatrains. Sonnets, for those who aren't familiar with them, always have 14 lines. And in the Shakespearean pattern, it's three quatrains of four lines each, plus a couplet that where the two lines rhyme with each other rather than alternating. And that the couplet always involves a shift, an unpredictable kind of shift.
Like a punchline.
Yeah. And here, the first two quatrains, the first eight lines, are all this one image of the a glorious morning turning into a dark, unpleasant day. And we suspect this is going to be an analogy, but it doesn't... It's simply the source of the image, not the target at this point in the poem. And then the next quatrain comes in, four lines that condense, as it were, the eight lines of that have gone before, the analogy between the relationship between the poet and presumably the young man he's been addressing up to now, his son, the person who was addressed, say, in that famous poem, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?"
Right. There's no way that this could simply be about the son.
Not really, because he's talking about my son, he, yet him for this my love no whit disdaineth. He wouldn't feel that towards the son.
And I don't know.
Sons of the world may stain when heaven's sun staineth. So there's a clear contrast between the sun and the sky and the sons of the world.
What's the meaning of that stain, though?
Yeah, isn't it a surprise?
Yes.
Because... You can understand, okay, the sun being covered in clouds and no longer shining, but staining, there's a kind of implied moral reproach there. And you don't know what the young man being addressed has done. You sense it must be some kind of a emotional betrayal. But, and this is what I mean about the non-narrative nature of these things, if Shakespeare wanted us to understand some kind of story, he could have spelled it out. But no, it's this this ominous, unpleasant adjective that suggests some kind of betrayal but doesn't spell anything out. One of the delights of reading the sonnets is that you can keep on unpacking them and unpacking them. And I think one of the brilliant things here about this sonnet is that those first eight lines offer you the image of the sun. They never actually mention the word sun. And, of course, the lines are about the concealment of the sun behind clouds. So Shakespeare conceals the word sun, although he allows it. He's got seen in the first of the eight lines and unseen in the last of the eight lines, almost playing with the word sun, but hiding it.
I like the word flatter.
Yes.
For the mountaintops. Would he have understood that to be a double entendre, as it were? You like, flatter the mountaintops, make the mountaintops lit up and beautify them, or...
Make them flatter?
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought of that, but yeah, possibly. It's interesting that... Here it's the monarch who's flattering the mountaintops, the monarch of the sky, as it were, the sun. And usually it's the flattery goes towards the monarch, but it's the sun who's making the mountaintops look even better than they usually do by flattering them with his sovereign eye.
Is this, I mean, why do you choose this? Is this one of your favourites?
I choose it partly because the sonnets that follow help make a very clear case for the non-narrative structure of the sonnets. And partly also for the fact that it's unlike all the other sonnets in all the other Elizabethan sonnet sequences and the Italian sonnet sequences, it starts to show real misgivings about the object of the love that the sonnets are expressing. There's something that's gone seriously wrong. And this kind of psychological complexity is something that Shakespeare brings in for the first time. And then the next sonnet, picks up on the sun image, but does it in a completely different way. So it starts off, "Why didst thou promise me such a beauteous day and make me travel forth without my cloak to let base clouds overtake me in my way, hiding thy bravery in their rotten smoke?" The Sonnet 33 had been absolutely impersonal. "Full many a glorious morning have I seen, flatter the mountaintops." No direct relationship of the poet to the person addressed, or the person in focus. It's a he. Here it's I to thou. And that kind of little subtle modification is what we get all the time in the sonnets. Then the next sonnet, Sonnet 34 starts to get more and more reproachful. "'Tis not enough that through the cloud thou break to dry the rain on my storm-beaten face, for no man well of such a salve can speak that heals the wounds and cures not the disgrace." There's a real insistent reproach here, and he says he's not going to be softened. He's going to reject any attempt by the young man to make up to him. But then in the last in the couplet, his love triumphs again. "Ah, but those tears are pearl which thy love sheds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds." And then the next poem goes on to the idea of reproaches again, and the poet making excuses for whatever the young man has done. And he ends saying that "I an accessory needs must be to that sweet thief which sourly robs from me." And then in the next poem, he completely flips it over. Instead of the young man being the person who's responsible for whatever it is that's damaged their relationship, he tries on the poet himself. What if I had been the one who was at fault? And given the fact that I love you so much, what would the consequences of that be? Well, in that case, I would ask you, if I'd done something heinously wrong, I would ask you to have nothing to do with me so that you wouldn't be damaged by association with me. And you can see from this that he's not really playing with he's not really telling a story.
This is why you call it more of a kaleidoscope of what-if situations.
Yes, yes. He's playing with things that are just a subtle shift. And the pattern looks similar to what was before, but fascinatingly different at the same time.
Are you suggesting that sexual selection, back to the evolution, sexual selection was the motivating force for him writing it, and is a motivating force for us reading them with enjoyment?
No. Sexual selection is one theory for art. So that Darwin was famously puzzled. He said that the very sight of peacocks' tails made him outraged because he couldn't explain why something so gaudy, something that clearly doesn't have an immediate practical benefit, could exist in nature, until he came up with a theory of sexual selection. That if a flashy tail appeals to females, then the flashier your tail, the better you're going to do. So there's going to be an evolutionary pressure to a flashier and flashier tail. And that has been applied to all sorts of human activities, including art. If you think of rock stars and the young women that they can attract, there clearly is an element of sexual selection in art. But I would insist that it's not the engine that drives art. It's only another gear.
So what is the engine?
I think it's this: the benefits that come from improving our capacity to understand pattern. We are creatures who depend for our success on information rather than our physical attributes. And the better we can handle information, the better we do. No organisms can handle information in real time unless they fall into patterns. And we become obsessed with playing with patterns through art in ways that I think have made us super information reshapers and pattern searchers. And of course, one of the attractions of Shakespeare's sonnets is that you can search for pattern endlessly. You can go deeper and deeper and see the patterns. It's like the Mandelbrot set, the fractals. You go deeper and deeper, and you see the overall pattern reflected in interestingly fascinating ways, perhaps skewed it the other way, and you go deeper and deeper, and you see more and more pattern. It's just inexhaustible.
But do you ever feel that we run the risk of overanalyzing?
Oh, we do.
Were Shakespeare to come back today, we'd go, "Oh, get a life! I never meant that."
Maybe. I think, on the other hand, I think there are clearly good analyses and bad ones, and I think he would be very chuffed to have found some of the good ones that he might have. He overloads things so much that he must have known that no audience was going to be able to take in as much as he had put into the plays on a first go, and I think I think he would be quite fascinated that he'd managed to hide things under people's noses in the sonnets, say, for centuries, but that slowly some of them are being unpicked. Not that everything is hidden, because nobody would read them if it was all hidden, but he offers enough on a first reading, and offers more on a second reading, more on a third reading, and keeps on offering it so that you feel compelled to come back to them.
I wanted to ask you about one thing. In discussing in your book Sonnet 30, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought.
That's right, yeah.
You say he was the first to use sigh with a direct object, I sigh the lack, rather than not sigh for the lack. What that seems innovative and original to us, but at the time, could that not have been an example of how fluid and unset English was?
No, I think if you look at other writers of his time, other major writers of the time, nobody violates the language quite as freely as he does. I think that's one of the delightful things. He just couldn't follow the regular rails of language. He drove wherever he wanted. He zoomed up in the air. He's untamable in language, and he always sees new opportunities, new ways of looking at character, at language, at anything.
The Mistress Sonnets, the Dark Lady Sonnets, the aforementioned Dawn Patterson, called the toxic Dark Lady junk.
Yes.
Why did he hate them so?
Because he thinks that they reflect a crude misogynism in Shakespeare, and that seems utterly crazy when you think of the glorious portraits of women in so many of the plays. But he thinks this is he's expressing a direct feeling of hatred towards a real mistress he had. I think Shakespeare is exploring the contradictions of desire. If you desire another person strongly, and yet you know that they're unfaithful. One of the things that I stress in my book is that instead of the idea of a poet trying to appeal endlessly to a woman who resists him, who has to keep on writing poem after poem after poem to try to persuade the woman to overcome her resistance, the Dark Lady is someone who resists no man. She's the bay where all men ride, as Shakespeare puts it. And even when she's out with him, she seems to be catching the eye of potential other conquests. So,
when you say the Dark Lady, there is some suggestion that she was literally a dark, like black or brown.
It's possible, but he only talks about her dark hair and her dark eyebrows, and you know, her skin is not as fair as convention would have it. But there's no, we don't know. It has been people have been hypothesized as the original of the Dark Lady, but I very strongly suspect that he made it up, made her up. You know?
Right. Yeah. So she's a generic and shifting woman. Although one poem, what is it, 1-4-5 for Anne Hathaway, fairly clearly is.
Yes, yes, and I think that's a delightful find.
My syntax has become as fluid as Shakespeare's just then, did you notice? Yeah, I mean, that's clear from the pun, isn't it, inherent in that sonnet,
yeah,
that it's for Anne Hathaway.
Yes, and that was a discovery made by our former a former member of my English department, Andy Gurr, in 1971, yeah. It's really lovely to... I mean, there's a clear example of sexual selection. It looks like people had thought it was inauthentic because it's so much inferior in quality to the other sonnets. And yet, if you see it as Shakespeare at 18, say, trying to woo, trying to impress, trying to be sexually selected by Anne Hathaway, then it suddenly is a very special charm. And it's fascinating that he should then throw a sonnet that he wrote for Anne Hathaway, the woman he married and had three children by, into a sequence of poems addressed to the dark lady.
Yeah.
Again, it's just incompatible with a purely narrative structure.
Somebody has texted, emailed to say, could it be that Shakespeare was simply writing to the paying audience of the time, that is the English ruling class, who've always had a preponderant but assiduously hidden homosexual, bisexual representation?
Well, sodomy was a capital crime in those days, so I don't think he was trying to advertise homoerotic element in himself. There had been poets who were much more clearly of a homosexual inclination, like Christopher Marlowe. Richard Barnfield also wrote a sonnet sequence, Michael Drayton, than Shakespeare. As I argue in the book, it's much more likely that Shakespeare was simply trying to find a way to get beyond the conventions of the sonnet sequence.
Also, they're kind of courtly love, aren't they?
Yes, they're certainly idealising, and many of the poems that are idealising, as you mentioned earlier, are actually not clearly addressed to a man, so they can be taken out of their context. And I think that was something that Shakespeare anticipated, that you could read some of the sonnets within sequence as being addressed to the young man, but then you can take them out. And so many of the very great sonnets were designed, I think, to be read out of context. Shakespeare knew that these ones were going to be popular hits and that they could be read on their own. So that a sonnet like Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day has no indication of gender. And, of course, most people, when they read it out of context, assume it's a man speaking to a woman.
So do you read them constantly again and again?
I did when I was working on the book. I mean, I've known them for a long time. It's not really the book rather took me by surprise. I was going to write one chapter in a sequel to On the Origin of Stories, and I was going to also deal with Hamlet and Twelfth Night and Pride and Prejudice and Ulysses and Art Spiegelman's Mouse. But so I was just going to address one chapter on lyric verse, on verse without narrative, and then it became two chapters, three, four, and a book before I knew it.
One thing leads to another. Mm. And now you're going to work on a biography of Karl Popper?
That's right, yes, I'm working on that right now.
You met him?
No, I nearly did. He was going to speak at Canterbury in 1973 when I was a student. No, or 71, when I was a student there. But he fell ill and he didn't give the lecture, and somebody else gave it in his place. And I thought, I objected to a lot of the ideas, and now I can't see what I objected to. Because
is that right?
Yeah.
What did you object to?
I really can't remember. Because it all makes such good sense to me now.
It's very nice to talk to you. When is that book coming out?
It'll be about 3 years away at the earliest, I think, yeah. It's I've got to read 750 rolls of microfilm of his archive.
It'll let you go then.
Yes.
Nice to talk to you, Professor Brian Boyd of the University of Auckland. Talking about his book, Why Lyrics Last, Evolution, Cognition and Shakespeare's Sonnets.